David Dominier, I want your opinion. When I title each episode, I try not to make it sound boring. Yet at the same time, it's important to let people know what the episode is all about to make them interested. And so I pondered the title for this particular episode. And really, once I thought about it, your book says it all. What do you think if I just simply call this episode David Dominier Tells the Tale of a Dark Room in Glitterball City?
I think that pretty much encompasses it all.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Let's give them what they want.
All right.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
Hi, I'm Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. As you heard just a moment ago, my guest is David Dominier. It's a little bit different today. We normally do crime fiction on the show, mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. David has done true crime, and we're going to talk about why in just a moment. But I wanted to let you know he is a college professor. He owns his own tour company where he lives. He's written 13 books that are on history, true crime, the paranormal. He's done cookbooks. And today we're talking about a true crime story called A Dark Room in Glitterball City. Welcome, David.
Welcome to you in Mexico City, where I'm sitting at my desk with a beautiful view. And thanks for having me on today.
I'm happy to have you on. Are you able to breathe out there today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's nice temperatures here compared to what it is in a lot of places back home.
Okay, I know Mexico had the pollution challenges, and I don't know if that's still true anymore.
They still do, but it's not as bad as it used to be. And this time of year, you know, it gets down to 60 or 50 degrees at night. You wake up, it's nice and fresh in the morning. The sun comes out and kind of dries up thing. It's kind of rainy season right now, so we have thunder showers in the afternoon. But for the most part, it's not too bad.
Okay, we get that in LA. It'll rain, and you're like, oh, yeah. There's a mountain there. I didn't even know that was there before. So I see where you're coming from. Now, your agent contacted me. Actually, it was last year because it was before the show went on hiatus. And she wanted to see about having you on the show. And as typical when people reach out to me that write nonfiction stories, I told her, this show is all about fiction novels. I don't think it'll be a good fit. Then I took a look at your book and all the information on it. And I said, let's do it. Of course, then I went on hiatus and I had to reach out to you again and say, let's still do it. And I'm glad you're here. And the reason why I chose to have you on, a couple of reasons is, one, the way the book is written. Primary reason is this is a fascinating story.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people have said it's true crime, it's nonfiction, but a lot of people say it reads like a novel. And that was kind of my intent, to make it read like a novel and draw people in. So it's kind of a good fit, I think, as well. I think you made a wise choice.
Well,
wise choice by having me on.
I definitely did, and it most definitely reads like a novel, without a doubt. You could read it and not realize you're reading a true story.
Mm-hmm. And truth is always stranger than fiction. I mean, you couldn't make the stuff up in this story.
And you actually say that in the book, and as I'm reading, I'm like, yeah, he's right. He's right. Mm-hmm. Totally right. Yeah. Before we get into the actual murder itself, I want to set up the story a bit about where we are. As I said, the title of the book is A Dark Room in Glitterball City, which already sounds a little ominous with the dark room in there. But what I find interesting, I've known Louisville by a couple of names. I even looked up to see what other names it's known by. And I know it's known by Gateway to the South and River City. And then I have heard it called The Ville. And I have heard it called, obviously, Derby City. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard of Glitterball City. First of all, tell people where Glitterball City is, because I don't think we've even said yet. And why do you call it that?
So, yeah, Louisville has a number of different nicknames. And another one you might have come across that's a less common one is Happy Birthday City, because it was in Louisville in 1893 that sisters Patty and Mildred Hill wrote the Happy Birthday song, the most sung song in the English language. So that's a very obscure nickname. But Glitterball City, and it's one that's becoming more known because of the book, and that was kind of my intent. My book tries to make Louisville a character. and showcase all the quirky and eccentric things about the city. But they call us Glitterball City because back at the height of the world's disco craze in the 70s and 80s, guess where all the disco balls were coming from? Louisville, Kentucky. And the company is still around today. They're called Omega National Products. And back in the day, the 70s and 80s, they had a crew of 25 women who would crank out disco balls by hand every day. Each one made 20 to 25 disco balls. Of those, there's only one left. Her name's Yolanda Baker, and she's still around. She's known as the reigning queen of disco balls. As far as we know, she's the last hand maker of disco balls left in the world. She doesn't make as many as she used to back then. She says that she makes 6 or 7 a week now. That's a lot, because by the mid-1990s, China had overtaken with mass production. So Louisville doesn't make the most of them anymore, but they still make what are considered the most iconic and the best quality and most recognizable ones. And all the disco balls people, you know, the people listening to the podcast have probably seen on TV and in movies. Those are Louisville disco balls. You know, that's what John Travolta was dancing under in Saturday Night Fever. That's what they had at Studio 54. If anyone's old enough to remember Don Cornelius, you know, Soul Train, that huge one, that was their most famous disco ball back in the day. And it's not surprising that a Louisville company would have this tradition with making disco balls, because it was a Kentuckian in 1917 already who first patented something called the myriad reflector. So that was kind of the early prototype disco ball. And throughout the decades, they've called it a number of things. Omega National Products officially calls theirs a mirror ball, but they've called it a glitter ball, and that kind of sticks in the Louisville area. But most people know it by disco ball because of the disco craze.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that you used the term glitter ball, because I was not really, I probably have heard that, but it's not what I tend to think of when I think of a disco ball.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, there's the gay angle of this story in the book, you know, glitter kind of fits in with the gay part. I'm kind of partial to glitter myself.
And of course, disco too.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's funny that you brought up the Happy Birthday City and the Happy Birthday song. This is something I've had to explain to people many times, that, because I read it somewhere decades ago. When you used to go to restaurants, they never sang Happy Birthday. They always sang some song that they made up, and people never knew why. And the reason is that song was copyrighted.
Correct.
If they wanted to sing it in a restaurant, they had to pay to use it. Now, that was finally ripped away. How long ago?
Oh, 8 or 9 years ago, there was a big court case. I forgot if it was Disney claiming they owned it, but it was one of the big production companies claiming that they had the rights to the Happy Birthday song. But the judge threw it out, said it was kind of absurd. So today it's back in the public domain again, and you can sing Happy Birthday on stage or in a restaurant and not have to worry about anyone coming after you.
Well, it's no surprise to me that Disney tried to claim it as their own. They tend to try and claim anything as their own.
Yeah, I'm not 100% certain it was Disney, but I think it was Disney. I could be wrong.
Well, it was in such common usage. It's kind of like Kleenex.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says, let me go get a tissue. They say, let me get a Kleenex, no matter what brand we're talking about. And you're from the South. Well, I, at least where I grew up in North Carolina, I know much of the South, people don't drink pop, and they don't drink soda. They drink Coke.
Well, everything's Coke.
Yes. Yeah. I'm getting a Coke. What kind would you like?
Yeah.
I'd like a 7-Up, please. I grew up as a little kid in Michigan. I never got used to the whole Coke thing. I thought it was ridiculous, but funny at the same time.
Yeah, I know. I'm from Wisconsin originally, so for me it was pop or soda. And, you know, Louisville's kind of right on the border. We're the, you know, the gateway to the South. You come the other way, we're the gateway to the Midwest. So as far as calling everything Coke, it's much less common in Louisville than other parts of the South.
Okay. That tended to be the thing, I know, in North Carolina. And I'm sure Georgia, where Coke is made, it's probably the thing that said. And what's funny, at least when I lived there, Pepsi was the most popular drink because it was sweeter.
Yeah.
Now, you have a lot of passions. And, I mean, I can't figure out how you do it all. You're a foodie. You're a good chef. You are into foreign languages, writing, teaching. You travel. But you have a special passion for a place, and it is a place in the city of Louisville. We're going to talk about the Dark Room, and we're going to talk about the house where the Dark Room exists, and we're going to talk about the city of Louisville, but this house and the Dark Room exist in a part of Louisville called Old Louisville. Why are you so passionate about this neighborhood?
So, like I said, I'm not from Louisville originally. I'm from Wisconsin. In the 1990s, I ended up going to Louisville to go to grad school and law school. And I didn't really want to go to Louisville, Kentucky. I had, you know, truthfully and unfortunately, I had a lot of the stereotypes that people have about Kentucky. I didn't think I was going to like it, but I ended up loving it. That was half my lifetime ago, you know. So I call it my hometown now because I've lived there more than any other place. But I moved into a neighborhood that is immediately south of the downtown area, and it's called Old Louisville. And Old Louisville is one of the largest historic preservation districts in the United States. There's 45 square blocks of old houses, roughly 1,400 structures in all, and most of these are old homes and Victorian mansions from the 1880s, 1890s. Some have said it's the largest Victorian neighborhood in the country, so I've always just been fascinated by old houses and American architecture. Anytime when I was young, I saw an old building being torn down, it just kind of tore up my heart. And so here I was living in the middle of this wonderful collection of old homes that a lot of people didn't know about. And that's kind of what won me over. It turns out I did like Kentucky, and Louisville turned out to be a very livable, welcoming city. But this area called Old Louisville is what really drew me in. Not only did it have wonderful architecture and just beautiful things to look at, these houses had stories, and I got to meet people and hear their stories and the family legends that were passed down. And it's always been kind of a bohemian part of town. Back in the 60s and 70s, you know, that's where the the hippies were living. And then, as is often the case with places, downtown areas that need some gentrification, if you want to call it that, or revitalization, a lot of it was the gay couples moving in and buying these houses and saving them and fixing
everywhere.
Them.
That happens everywhere.
Yep. And so it just, there were so many reasons why I fell in love with the neighborhood. And then the longer I stayed, you know, the more I found out about the neighborhood and the city and the more quirky people I met. And it's kind of a smorgasbord for quirks and eccentricities and old money, new money, scandal. You know, any community, any society has its seedy underbelly. So there's just, you know, everything in Old Louisville. And it just provided an unending source of wealth for me to come up with information to write about.
Back when I wrote my first novel a few years ago, I was describing a neighborhood and I got on Google Maps and toured around the neighborhood and to find out if things were where I remember they were. And I'm glad I did because I had some things wrong. But I fell in love with both Google Maps and Google Earth for that reason. So I did look at some of the pictures of Old Louisville, but then I got on Google Maps and I toured some of the streets. And I want to tell you, I've lived all over the country. I used to work in the hotel industry and I was moved a lot. And almost every city I lived in had a neighborhood that was at one time mansions that were eventually converted over to apartments and became run down and then turned around and people were buying them up and renovating them to turn them back into their old glory. So it's not the only city that's doing that, but I got to tell you, it is the most beautiful neighborhood of any of those I've seen. They're just incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's known as a Victorian neighborhood. And most Americans, when they hear this term Victorian, you know, they think of the typical gingerbread style, like the famous painted ladies in San Francisco and elsewhere. It's the style known as Queen Anne architecture. And Old Louisville has Queen Anne houses, but they have all these other houses that are considered Victorian styles as well. You got Chateauesque, Renaissance Revival, Richardsonian, Romanesque, Italian at Beaux-Arts. You got arts and crafts. Every house is just totally different from the one next door. So it's like a perfect backdrop for stopping and telling stories.
Now, this story takes place about 2010. We're sticking with this neighborhood. And you describe it a lot as, well, let's just say it's colorful. It's a little bit seedy. There's crime going on. There's drug dealing going on. You describe a good number of homeless folk that definitely are very interesting, and including an incident where you walked on a gentleman who was naked and was just fine naked. He didn't even want the clothes you were offering him.
Uh-huh.
That was 10 years ago. So given over that decade plus, has that seediness reduced as more people have come in and renovated the area, or does it still have that?
You know, a lot more of the neighborhood has been renovated, and the word's getting out. They're saying it's going to be the new Savannah, the new Charleston. So people are coming from more expensive places. They're selling their small house back in Chicago or Dallas or New York or Los Angeles. And you can go to Louisville, the old Louisville part of town, and you can still get a mansion for $500,000, like with 8-10 bedrooms, 6,000 square feet, in good shape, not a fixer-upper. So every week I meet a new couple or two. So they're taking the neighborhood back, but there's still these pockets. You know, the edges of the neighborhood is still a little seedy. And the thing is, in the city itself, the old timers have always thought of it as a bad part of town. So they haven't really been keeping up. You know, in 1975, it was recognized by the National Register of Historic Places. Back then, over 90% of the places were chopped up into cheap apartments and rooming houses. But since 75, because of the grassroots movements and the people fighting to save these old houses, over half of them are back to single family. And a lot of good things are going on. But it's one of those places, it seems like every time they take a step forward, they take two steps back. And a lot of it isn't helped by the fact that the local media and a lot of the old timers still think of it as a bad part of town. So a lot of times it's the out of towners like me that arrive in the neighborhood. They see the neighborhood with fresh eyes. They see the potential, and they're the ones buying the places and fixing them up. But a lot of the problems, you know, I'm putting these in air quotes, that we have, because they're problems any city has across the United States, drug issues, petty crime, homelessness, things like that, has to do with NIMBYism, you know, the not in my backyard syndrome. Mm-hmm. Old Louisville has always been a place for local churches who originally might have had their congregations in that neighborhood or nearby, for them to keep their homeless shelters and their clothing banks and soup kitchens and things like that. So at the edge of Old Louisville, there's like 12 different social service agencies that cater to marginalized people. And it's nice that these churches and charities want to do good works, but they don't want to do the good works in their neighborhoods. They concentrate them all near Old Louisville, so that affects what people experience when they come to the neighborhood.
Yeah, I lived in one in North Carolina, a historical neighborhood. I lived in an old apartment that was built in 1914, but most of the neighborhood were the old mansions that people were renovating, and a sober living was being put in. A company or an individual was going to put in sober living, which means guys just out of recovery, newly recovered alcoholics, were going to be moving in. And to alleviate any trouble, they sent around flyers to the whole neighborhood to say, this is what we are. If you have any issues, come talk to us. And you know what? The whole city was like, or the whole community was like, that's cool. That's cool that you're doing that. But that is really rare. I still look back on that. I'm like, I think it was because they were up front.
Yeah. There are one or two places like that in the neighborhood. They're more on the residential core, so they've tried to be mindful of their neighbors. But like I said, a lot of these places I mentioned, they're kind of in the area, kind of the no man's land at the very edge of Old Louisville as it bleeds into the downtown area. And a lot of them, yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
In 2009, I believe that was the year, you almost bought a mansion in Old Louisville at 1435 4th Street.
Yeah, it's 2008, actually.
Okay, 2008. All right. I knew I was close. I didn't think I was right on the money. You and your husband went and took a look at this house that was for sale. And it sounds very pretty the way you described it, but it was a little more work than you wanted to do.
It was a lot more work than I wanted to do.
Yeah. So after you took the tour, this is how the book opens. After you took the tour of the house, as you were leaving, a man from Chicago was coming in to have a look at this house. And he is not so insignificant. This is actually very interesting. You chose not to buy that house because it had too much work, but that man from Chicago did.
Yeah, and he's actually from Louisville, but he had been working and living in other places. So he had just been in Chicago for several years. So he decided he was going to come back to Louisville. And he planned on buying the house and turning it into a bed and breakfast. And the reason I was interested in the house is because we lived in a big house just around the corner on 4th Street that we had restored. And as you mentioned, I was a food writer at the time. I was working on my first cookbook. And I heard that this house, 1435 South 4th Street, which locals call the Richard Robinson House, I heard they had the original wine cellar from when the family built it. And I thought, ooh, I want a wine cellar. And so we went and looked at the house, and it was... Our house was a small house by old Louisville standards. It only had about 7 bedrooms. It was about 4,000 square feet.
Oh, yeah. Who would want that?
Yeah. This one had like 12 bedrooms. It was over 11,000 square feet. So we went and looked at it. And like you said, it was beautiful on the inside. A lot of great details, hardwood floors with parquet inlay, fireplace mantel, stained glass, leaded glass windows. But it needed a lot of work. And we went down into the wine cellar. And you could barely tell it was a wine cellar. It had a dirt floor. You could see like the faint outlines of shelves that had been built against the wall at one time. But previous tenants had just thrown in boxes of garbage and junk. And it was just a mess. It was just way too much work. So we decided, no, thanks. And we went to the house where we live today. But yeah, as we were leaving, going down the front stairs, the guy rushed up the stairs to meet his agent. And that's the guy you're talking about, Jeffrey Munt.
Jeffrey Munt. So let's get into Jeffrey Munt. I'm going to skip that. Because one of the things I had loved when you two were walking around the house, you stumbled on a lot of nun porn, which I didn't know. It doesn't surprise me, but I didn't really know was a thing.
Neither did I. Yeah, neither did I. Yeah, it turns out a prior... So basically... The house had been owned by an older woman for the previous 30, 35 years. And she eventually just ended up living in one small part of the house and renting out rooms and kind of studio apartments in the rest of the house. And she'd rent to anybody. And the house, you know, had fallen on hard times. She was too old to get around and kind of check on the place. But someone who was living in the house had a thing for nun porn. And out in the back, when we went to look at the carriage house, there was kind of like a rubbish heap, and there were two big cardboard boxes. It was kind of full of Pulp Fiction and old magazines. It looked like from the 60s and 70s, maybe the 50s. But yeah, it was nuns yielding rulers and spanking bare-bottomed girls. And I mean, it was quite an education. I didn't know it was a thing.
So you mentioned Jeffrey Munt, who I alluded to earlier, the guy from Chicago who did buy the house. And it's interesting, I don't recall, and I'm sure you mentioned in the book, that he bought it to turn it into a bed and breakfast. And I find that fascinating because he wasn't such a good guy. I mean, we're leading up to a murder here, but something that I don't, gay men and murder, we hear about that all the, you know, and I'm not just talking about Dahmer, I mean, it happens everywhere. But he was also involved in counterfeiting money, robbery, things of that nature. And I don't tend to think of gay men as common thugs. And I'm sure it's just totally a stereotype. There's probably just as many as there are everyone else in the world. Mm-hmm. But it really caught me off guard. Is that one of the reasons why did other people find that surprising?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted to write the book, because this terrible murder was uncovered in the house. And then as details began emerging, it turns out there was all this other stuff going on in the house. You know, the guys had been counterfeiting money there. They had been doing other things there, and other people had died in the house, and other weird things had happened in the house. It had been a sanatorium. So the house itself was just a character. It had a whole century's worth of stories to tell and strange goings on. So yeah, to the extent that I found out about some of Jeffrey Munt's side interest, it was a little surprising. You know, murder, or at least covering up a murder, you know, is one thing, but then all these other things he was involved in, kind of interesting.
And that house wasn't just the only physical character in the story. I mean, even the city itself is very much a character of the story. And you lay the groundwork to really tell a good story that is unique to that particular area. And that's why I wanted to lead off with that. But now that we are there, Mr. Munt, the pleasant gentleman, bought this house on 4th Street. And I'm going to let you tell the story. What happened?
Yeah. So we went and looked at the house, like I said, in 2008. We decided no. It was 2 years later. It was the morning of June 18th, 2010. I got up, turned on the local news and was drinking my coffee. And all of a sudden, a familiar-looking house popped up on the screen. It was a big, boxy, red brick house, an Italianate house. But there were police cars out front, and there was yellow and black caution tape cordoning off the whole front yard. And all of a sudden, a mugshot popped up on screen. And the house looked familiar. I was trying to place what house that was. And then this mugshot popped up on the screen, and all of a sudden, I realized what house it was. It was 1435 South 4th Street, the old Richard Robinson house. And the mugshot that popped up was Jeffrey Munt. And it turns out he and his boyfriend, Joseph Bannis, they call him Joey, who also had just moved back from Chicago not too long before, and who comes from a very prominent family in Louisville, those two had just been arrested, and the police and reporters, you know, were swarming the area. What happened was the previous evening, about 9:30, 911 was called, and it was Jeffrey Munt telling the police to hurry and come because he was barricaded in a bedroom on the second floor of the mansion, and Joey, his boyfriend, was out in the hallway with a hammer trying to break through the wooden door to come inside and murder him. So the police responded, and they thought they were just kind of breaking up a domestic disturbance, a lover's quarrel. And as you do, each officer took one party aside, separated them, and tried to get their version of events. And in the process of questioning the two parties, they began hearing grumblings from one of the guys about somebody knowing something where a body was buried. And they didn't really take it seriously at first. But then Joey Bannis gave them a name. He said he knew where the body of Jamie Carroll was, a guy from Eastern Kentucky who had been missing for 7 months. And he said, people don't even know he's missing. And so detective kind of reluctantly began to call around. And within an hour or two, they found out, oh, sure enough, a guy named Jamie Carroll from the Allen Martin part of the eastern part of the state, you know, he'd been missing for 7 months and nobody did know he was missing. And all of a sudden, they realized Joey Bannis knew something. And so they interrogated him for hours. And finally, he broke down and told them where the body was. And of course, where was the body? It was buried in the dirt floor of the wine cellar. That was kind of the selling point of the house for me, why I wanted to buy the house. And police came. They got a search warrant because they heard that they had workers scheduled to come over like the next day, possibly, or the day after to come and concrete everything over. So they got a search warrant. They rushed, went down into the basement, and they started to dig. And you can see what they found that night because A&E was in town. Louisville is one of the cities that has a contract with A&E to let them film their police for a show called The First 48. So The First 48 filmed all this. The episode is called What Lies Beneath, and it's one of several national true crime shows that have done the story about this house now. And what they found beneath was 4 feet below the surface of the dirt floor. They found a blue Rubbermaid container, and in it were the remains of Jamie Carroll. He had been shot, stabbed with a hunting knife. They'd use a sledgehammer to fit his body inside. And so they dug out the body, and then, of course, the question was, well, who killed him and why? Well, both the guys, Jeffrey Munt and Joey Bannis, eventually admitted to disposing of the body and kind of covering things up. But they both pointed the finger at each other and claimed the other had killed Jamie Carroll and that he had been living in fear of the other for the previous 7 months. And that's why they hadn't gone to police. So 3 years later, Louisville had its most scandalous murder trial in a long time. They called it the trial of he said, he said. Some people dubbed it the pink triangle murder because Joey, Jeffrey, and Jamie were romantically involved. And it was actually the night all three of them were in bed together. Afterwards, something happened that ended up costing Jamie Carroll his life.
Well, it was three men in bed together doing drugs at the same time. This is a National Enquirer dream.
Well, and when the story broke, I mean, and it was like Pride weekend when the story broke.
Oh, that sucks. Yeah.
It was just everyone hopped on the bandwagon about the gay aspect. You know, it wasn't just a gay victim. It was a gay couple. And so all the salacious gay details were kind of brought to the front. Some people shied away from it, though. They don't want to appear homophobic. And they think that's one of the reasons why it didn't get more national coverage, because this was could have been a huge national story. But when the trials took place in Louisville, it was actually at the same time when the Jodi Arias trials were taking place out west. And if you remember, she was the woman in California who drove all the way to Arizona to stab her Mormon boyfriend and then, you know, lied about it. And that trial took like months. This one, it was two separate trials. Each one was like 3 or 4 weeks long. But they said had that Jodi Arias trial not dominated the news, that the Jamie Carroll murder trial probably would have been the national headlines.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead to the end here. And there's a reason why I'm going to do that. So in the end, when the trials were over, Joey Banas went to prison for murder for the rest of his life. Jeffrey Munt went to jail for a short period. I mean, it was based on the incident. It was a slap on the hand. Do you think justice was served there? I know what the police think. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a Joey Banas got 20 to life. He's in prison today. He could get out like in another 15 years or so. I forget, maybe like 2037 or something. I think he could get out on parole. But he was convicted of all the major counts, you know, murder. He was just acquitted of two minor counts. But yeah, Jeffrey Munt, he was acquitted of all but two minor charges. So he only got 8 years for his part. And with the time he had served and then doing another year after the trial, he was out on parole in 2014 already. And a lot of people, they think he's the one that got away with murder. Chuck Gowdy, an investigative reporter for ABC News in Chicago, he did a series of stories about Jeffrey Munt because he had been kind of a big shot at Northwestern University, where he was in charge of a very prestigious kind of IT overhaul for the university technology system. And one of the stories he did was how to get away with murder. And he basically comes out and said Jeffrey Munt is the one that got away with murder. But it is such a bizarre case, and there's so many weird angles and tangents. Every time I go back and, for example, rewatch the trial tapes, because in Kentucky they record everything on video, or if I even go back and reread my book, I always notice something else and I kind of start leaning a different way. So it kind of depends what direction the wind is blowing, whether or not I think justice was served. The more I find out, and of course, since the book has come out, a lot of people have come out of the woodwork and shared stories about, you know, the people involved. Of course, I wish they would have done that before.
Of course, yeah.
When I was doing all the research and stuff. But I tend to think that the prosecution kind of was on the right track, that they both were culpable. Because the way the verdicts came down, Jeffrey Munt was very minorly culpable. He was only convicted of, you know, tampering with evidence and covering up the body, stuff like that. But what I found out, I think he did know more. There were several times he was caught in lies on the stand and some things that just popped out that point at him knowing more than he was letting on. But what happened was there was this weird suicide tape that came out in the second trial, Jeffrey Munt's trial. And basically, Joey Banas confessed to killing someone. And so Jeffrey Munt, the reason I think he got off is, well, first, the defense team he had was great, and they were able to plant a lot of doubt in the heads of the jurors. But by that point, they had already had a guilty conviction. Joey Banas had been convicted of the murder. So the defense was able to say, you know, we already got the murder. He's in prison already. So I think that was one of the reasons. And then they had this tape where Joey Banas, the one who was already convicted, confesses to a murder, you know, on tape. It was a bizarre tape. Some think it was staged, but they had this confession from him. And that tied with the fact that they were able to play the 911 call that was made the evening of June 17, 2010 to the jurors, which they didn't do during the first trial. And people were able to hear the terror in Jeffrey Munt's voice as he was making the 911 call. And you could hear Joey pounding on the door, trying to break through with the hammer. Hearing how terrified Jeffrey Munt was, and then finding out more about Joey Banas and how he had been surveilling him and had a tracking GPS system installed in his car so he could watch exactly where he was going. And then other people coming out and talking about kind of what a psychopath Joey Banas was. It was not surprising at all that they were able to acquit Jeffrey Munt of a lot of the worst charges.
And as you said, this was he said, he said. So Jeffrey said Joey did it. Joey said Jeffrey did it. Bannis is the one who went to prison. And it's very interesting. I found a website for prisoners looking for pen pals. And Mr. Bannis is looking for pen pals. If anybody's interested, you can go online and he wants to be your pen pal. And in that, he still insists that he was not the one that killed the person. He said, I am here for... He didn't mention the killing, even though the...
He said, I did not do what they're accusing me of doing.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he, up to the end, I mean, all his appeals have been exhausted as far as we know. He went through several different appeals. They were all turned down. The last one, and I found this out by talking to his defense attorney, Darren Wolf, was the old chestnut of arguing incompetent defense. And he tried that, and that one didn't work. So unless he can come up with something really great, his appeals process is exhausted as far as I know.
Well, he's been there for a pretty long time now.
Since, well, when they were arrested in 2010, since then, basically. So he's going on 13 years now.
I want to say when I was reading the book, and you brought this up earlier, that it reads like a fiction story. I was kind of uneasy. I was like, this is kind of weird that it's, I don't know what, there's a couple terms used for it. One is narrative nonfiction and the other is creative nonfiction. Do you use either of the two terms?
Creative nonfiction.
Okay, creative nonfiction. And I thought it was new to me. And then I realized I'd read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, which was written creative nonfiction. Explain to people what that means. I think we kind of already told them, but a little more detail.
You know, it depends which writer you talk to and what book you're referencing. But creative nonfiction is just, it's nonfiction, but the author has some artistic license, you know. And I'm glad you pointed out In Cold Blood, because as I started writing this story, publishers, you know, publishing houses were wanting to know, you know, what kind of book it compared to, you know, how could they market this? And In Cold Blood was one that came up a lot. And then the other was John Barron's Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And that one, I never shied away from that. He was always an inspiration to me. And I even acknowledge him in the book. And then I did my Master of Fine Arts in creative writing, and my specialization was creative nonfiction. And so, yeah, depending on who you talk to, creative nonfiction involves more creativity, or to a certain degree, a greater amount of creativity than straight nonfiction. But everything, for me, everything is fiction. Because even if you see something and you try to recount what you saw, you write it down on the page, you're not being faithful to what you actually saw. Your memory might not recall something exactly, even if it just happened 10 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a counterfeit narrative. Whatever you're writing is not the real thing. You're trying to recreate it as best as you can. My field of discipline is translation. And so I studied translation theory and technique. And in the world of translation, there's two poles, you know. There's like dynamic equivalence or formal equivalence. You know, when you're translating things using the formal approach, you're going more literally, the word by word translation. When you're doing it dynamically, you're going more for the feelings and the moods that are captured and the basic message. And so I find that writing is a lot like that. And you kind of put, you know, nonfiction versus fiction on those poles. But it is creative nonfiction, but where I use creative license basically is in the chronology. Sometimes people will exercise great creative license. For example, I studied John Barron's book a lot. I read the book, I think, 6 times, and then I listened to it 57 times on Audible. I had it on loop the last several years I was working on this book. I wanted to find out what worked, you know, with his book. And then I tried to learn about him and his technique and his background. And in doing research on Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, I found out one of his characters was a dead character. She had died already 30, 40 years before the story took place. And he resurrected her from the dead. You know, he put a historical character like she was there in real life. And then he most famously refers to himself as the only fictitious character in the book, because he writes as if he were there the whole time and witnessing all this, and he wasn't. He came in at the very end of the story, and he went back and he recreated things, inserting himself as an eyewitness when he wasn't there. And so for me, I was there from the very beginning, and I take a linear approach. What I do, where I do use some creative license, is with the chronology. I bookend the story with a prologue and an epilogue, and both involve my partner and I looking at the house and considering buying it. Well, the epilogue, actually, that second look at the house really took place right after the trials ended, and I make it seem like it took place in 2021, so I pushed it back because I wanted to bookend the story like that. And then so much time had passed. I had spent 10 years working on the book, so I was able to kind of put a memoir twist to the book. I was able to go back and reflect on things, and having that second look at the house kind of end the book allowed me to look back through a lens and update readers on what had happened in the meantime since the trial ended, and the people involved, how they had been affected, and people we lost and things like that, and how the pandemic kind of tied in. So that's where I took some creative license. And then with the chronology as well, like parties. There were a lot of parties in old Louisville, and party scenes are notoriously hard to write. Mm-hmm. And so instead of recreating each individual party verbatim as it happened, or each gathering where I met people, I would take different two or three different parties or events and kind of combine them and the people I met into one, which I thought was the most interesting event or something. So that's, for me, that was the extent of my creative license for the most part. But other writers, you know, and some have gotten in trouble. You know, there's famous cases of people who said they wrote memoirs and basically it was just made up. So that's, I think, going a little too far. But creative nonfiction can go a lot of different ways.
And yours is a little different in the sense that you are telling it from your perspective. It's told in first person and you are the narrator. So it is a little different than other creative nonfiction I'm familiar with, where everything is speculation. However, as you said, there are events that took place and conversations that took place that I'm like, nobody would have known this verbatim, the words that come out of a person's mouth. So are there ethical issues you have to be really careful with?
Yeah. And especially when you're dealing with real life people, you know, anything that I thought could be defamation, I always shy away from. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, if you're writing, you know, they say if you're a writer and you're not pissing people off, you're not doing a good job writing. And especially when you're writing true crime and stuff. So I like for some things that people said, I've got a good memory, and people I've interviewed for books and stuff before, a lot of times I don't take notes. I talk to them and then I go back and I recreate the dialogue. And people I've interviewed for books before, they've said, how are you able to, you recreated verbatim what our conversation was. How are you able to do that? And so I have a decent memory and I can recall the most important things. Maybe the syntax of what they said might be a little different, but the gist has to be there. I mean, the nuts and bolts of what they're saying and the intent has to be there. And of course, you make mistakes. You know, writers always make mistakes. If you make a mistake and it's in good faith, you know, that happens. And the more you write, you know, the more mistakes you're going to make. But I just have always tried to write things truthfully, or at least as I saw them. And it was good that you pointed out that I wrote this in the first person, because basically the whole thing, it is my story. I mean, it's a murder story, but it's basically how I was involved in the murder and then how I dealt with going to the trials and having to talk to people and trying to figure out what was going on and knowing the people in the neighborhood that was being affected by this murder and things. So me, like I said, taking that kind of memoir slant and putting it in a first person, it allowed me a certain degree of subjectivity. And if there were cases where people didn't come off as favorably as they would have liked to have come off, well, those are the people who were involved in the murder. And, you know, don't angle a body and bury it in your wine cellar floor and, you know, you won't look bad. Or there are a couple of neighborhood scandals. I didn't bring in real names, but people in the neighborhood know who, you know, the story is about. And sometimes I did things to kind of disguise, you know, I changed the gender or the descriptions of certain individuals just to give them a certain degree of protection. But if you live in old Louisville or you live in Louisville, you probably know some of these people I'm writing about, even though I don't mention them by name.
And it's funny that you were talking about the story is your story, because not only do you narrate it, even though this is about two guys that committed murder and of course, the murder victim. And you have a whole cast of interesting characters that you wrote about here. You are really not only the narrator, you're the protagonist in this story.
Kind of, yeah.
It's about your investigation is really what it's about.
Yeah, and it's kind of my process as a writer as well, because the nonfiction things I had written before, they were, you know, kind of folklore, ghost stories, and, you know, supposedly true ghost stories, but, you know, some people don't believe in ghost stories, so they think it's fiction if you're writing a ghost story. I did a lot of travel writing and things like that. But yeah, this was the first time where I wrote true crime, and I had to kind of be an investigative journalist, and I'm not an investigative journalist. I try to employ journalistic techniques, but I'm not the kind that can go call people and knock on their door and try to force them to talk to me. A lot of times I was in situations where I was rubbing salt in open wounds, and I didn't want to do that. So I let people know, and, you know, certain people who were involved, I let them know I wanted to talk to them. I was open to talking to them, but I didn't like track people down and annoy people. So part of the story is me, you know, at first wondering if I could write something like this and do the things I have to do to, you know, dig up this information. And finally, there was this tipping point. I realized the story's too good, you know, not to write. I have to write it. And if I have to step on some toes and hurt some feelings, you know, that might be a price I have to pay in the end.
See, I think I would have said, oh, this is a great story. I'm going to write a fiction novel that's kind of like this. And I think you took a much more interesting spin on how to do it. Because it doesn't read like Helter Skelter.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, like I said, truth is always, you know, stranger than fiction. And the fact that we're talking about real life characters and real events and real, you know, things, it seems more valid for a lot of people, I think, if you can say it's a true story.
And you told me that Hollywood is looking very seriously at this story. That's so interesting.
Oh, yeah. So the good thing is the book came out. I got a good review in the New York Times, and then started getting proposals and Hollywood and New York studios calling me. So something is in development right now, but it's too early. I can't reveal anything. But if you cross your fingers, in a year or two, there might be something on TV or the screen that has Glitterball City in the title.
Well, my fingers and toes are crossed, not only because I'd like to see it on the screen, but it would be good for you, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I hope. Your lips to God's ear, let's put it that way.
Before I let you go, there is something I'm really interested in. You mentioned true ghost stories. And you have a tour company in Louisville where you give people a tour of old Louisville and the city. And one of the tours you have is it called Victorian Ghost Walk?
That is a yearly theatrical event. So every night we do a ghost tour, a walking ghost tour through the neighborhood. And 1435 South 4th Street, of course, is the most popular stop. But yeah, every autumn we do kind of a scripted tour. And it's a fundraiser for the 4th Street Neighborhood Association, where the murder house, as the locals call it, is located. And instead of me or one of my guides taking groups around and telling stories, which is basically what our evening ghost tours is all about, for the Victorian Ghost Walk, which is always the third weekend in October, that Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, every 15 minutes, groups depart with a guide from the Conrad Caldwell House. That's our big historic home that's open for tour, and it figures prominently in the book as well. But instead of the guides telling story at every location, there are actors in Victorian attire, and they come to life and they tell the stories as the characters. And many of them are standing on their front porches where they died or were killed. Some of them are in their front parlor. So some of the stops, you go inside a house and there, you know, a former resident comes to life and tells his or her phantom tale of woe. So it's a fun event. This is going to be our 14th year to do it.
If you look up David Dominay, you'll be able to find information on his tour company. But what is the name of the tour company?
Called Louisville Historic Tours.
And I wanted you to say that because not only did the New York Times like your book, they also recommend your tour.
Yeah, several years ago for their, you know, they always do a 36 hours feature for a certain city, you know, the things you should not miss as a tourist. Yeah, several years ago, they did a 36 hours in Louisville, and ours was the first thing they recommended to do.
Well, something that wowed me even more, TripAdvisor, 300, somewhere between 300 and 350 people reviewed your tour. You got 5 stars. Any author in the world would love 350 people to review their book and get 5 stars. That's just amazing.
Yeah. So far, so good.
The reason I wanted to get to the ghost stories is because I know you're a skeptic, you say. You tell these true ghost stories, but you don't necessarily, you aren't saying 100% sure they are true. And the reason I'm bringing it up is I'm definitely, as a kid, I used to believe ghost stories big time, just like I used to believe in UFOs. Well, I used to believe in flying saucers, let me add. UFOs do exist, unidentified flying objects. But I'm much more of a skeptic these days. There's not much of me that believes in ghosts anymore. However, I know you said there were some things that happened in your house that was supposedly haunted that you can't explain. When I was a kid, I grew up in a small Michigan town. We lived on the outskirts of town, and there was a cemetery nearby with a mansion across the street that was supposed to be haunted. Well, one day I went into the bathroom, and I went back to the bedroom where I shared with my brother, and I couldn't open the door. And I had to push and push, and the reason I couldn't open the door was a bunk bed had been pushed in front of the bedroom door. So once I was able to get the door open enough that I could slide in and shut the door, I kept it closed because I wanted to find my brother, and he wasn't there. I'm a skeptic too, but how would you explain something like that?
Well, that's the thing. I'm a skeptic too, but there's always these 5% of 100 times when you just can't explain something like that. And yeah, you were right. The house we lived in before we thought about buying, 1435 South 4th Street, supposedly was haunted. The previous owner, before we moved in, she said, "Now, you know, you're going to get a ghost if you buy this house. You know, her name's Lucy. She's a poltergeist. She walks up and down the hallway on the second floor. She's going to tease your cats and dogs. Don't hang a picture on this wall. If you do, she'll knock it down." Well, I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And I bought the house, moved in, and everything the previous owner said would happen began to happen. In the end, though, I never did see a ghost, put it that way. People staying in the house, they said they had seen apparitions. I never saw an apparition. And I say seeing is believing. You know, when a ghost walks up and shakes my hand, I'll start believing in them. But short of that, I experienced a lot of things that people would say were paranormal. Within a couple of weeks of moving in, we began hearing footsteps in the middle of the night. And, you know, I discovered old houses make a lot of noise, but these weren't random creaks and groans. I was hearing what sounded like hard-soled shoes softly treading up and down the length of the hallway. Always between like 3 and 4 in the morning, always when I was there alone. So I just put my head under the pillow. I'm like, la, 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 just imagining this, you know, you're psyching yourself up. But I saw things move on occasion. And my three dogs, my three cats, they would do crazy things, like they were watching something and chasing something I couldn't see. So I never did see the ghost I was hoping to see, but a lot of strange things happen. So I'm open to the paranormal. You know, I wish I would see a ghost one day. I think the more you want to see a ghost, the less it's going to happen.
Yeah.
What fascinates me is there is something there, and I don't necessarily believe it's chain-rattling Victorian ghosts. I think more and more scientists are talking about quantum physics and things like that, maybe mm-hmm. time loops and things like that. And I think there are different kinds of energies. And even if it's mass hallucination, or for me, I think a lot of it was just weird coincidences, this convergence of all these weird things happening at once. Whatever it is, I just think it's fascinating and how human nature deals with it. And humans love to be frightened. We love to be scared, and we love to have stories to tell about it afterwards. And that's kind of what fascinates me. And stories are living, breathing things. And folklore has always fascinated me as well. So the ghost stories allow me to kind of contribute to the local folklore. And now this new book, A Dark Room in Glitterball City, helps me perpetuate that, because I hope a lot of the places mentioned in the book kind of become part of the local lore and legend in Glitterball City.
Well, given that we've only had an hour, you only have heard just a little bit about this story. So there will be a link in the show notes to David's website. And you also find it interesting, he not only writes this book, he also wrote some cookbooks and has written, as we mentioned, some books on ghost stories. This book, there is a lot to tell. And again, it is A Dark Room in Glitterball City by David Dominier. And it's riveting. It's a good story told in a fictional way.
Good. And then in the future, you can have me back on to talk about my fictional crime story, because I'm working on a murder mystery series right now. And the heroine is a drag queen by the name of Poo Poo Chiffon. So hopefully in a couple of years, you can have me back to talk about Poo Poo Chiffon.
Well, the character named Poo Poo Chiffon, how could I not have you back on? I mean, it's a given. We'll just have to set the date. It's a done deal.
All right. Sounds good.
David, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here.
Thank you for the book.
Thank you.